don't talk about it. Give me a heads up.
I was thinking of digging for dirt on some of your famous teammates. So. All right.
Who can I stitch up, mate? Who do I want to stitch up? I'll make a lie up.
Save that for later.
Hello and welcome to episode 9 of the V2 Academy. I'm Chris Laffin and joining me today I've got Peter Prickett.
Hi, how you doing?
Right, we're delighted to be joined online by John Curtis. How are you doing this evening, John?
I'm good, thank you, very good.
Have you been since we last spoke?
Not that busy. It's chaotic over here. Yeah, things are going pretty well.
Yeah, it was just after Christmas we spoke, I think.
It was, yeah. A lot's happened, lots changed, but it's all good.
Right, so we'll start a little bit with you in the Manchester United Academy. So you're obviously a product of the United Youth System. How were you spotted?
It's funny because Jeff Watson, who was at the club, I think he ended up being head of recruitment for a very long time, was the West Midlands scout. I'm from a town called Nuneaton.
Yeah.
Jeff spotted me playing for my local district team, which was Nuneaton and Bedworth District. It was once you got up to that level, just outside, the next level above the school level, that you really started to see the scouts come to games, and that's really where they started picking up the players. So, like many kids my age, that's where I was first really noticed.
Yeah, so do you remember your first day at United? Do you remember?
First day?
Yeah.
Well, what we used to do on a regular basis, we used to head up to the cliff and Littleton Road, and we'd stay up at the Salford University Halls of Residence, just up a little bit from Littleton Road, a bit further up.
Yeah.
So it would have been school holidays, half terms, Easters, things like that, coming up and staying with all the kids from all over the country. We used to get kids in from Ireland, Northern Ireland, Scotland, etc., and getting everybody together up there and really having a look at them. In like little camps, basically, little training camps we'd do, and it was great fun. It was fantastic to just to be. We at that stage, you're not really mixing around the first team. You'd see them. We stayed at Littleton Road, at different times, but we'd have games against the local teams as well. So it was great. It was absolutely great.
How old were you at that time?
Probably 14, something like that, 13, 14, when I first started, travelling. I was pretty lucky. When I was a young, that age, I was sought after. So it would be, Easter at United, half term at Arsenal, Christmas at Villa or Blackburn or Leeds or somewhere else. And my mum and dad weren't pushy at all, they're United fans, or my dad is anyway. Mum could take it or leave it, but they never pushed me in one direction, and they always said, "Go and experience all these clubs, and you make the decision, John." Which was great, which was absolutely perfect. So I got to see, lots and lots of clubs all over the country. Even went up to Rangers, which was a great experience as well.
So, which club would have been your first contact with the academy system, as we now call it?
Stoke City ran a centre of excellence in Nuneaton, in a place called Arley, and I used to go up there every Friday night and train with Dick Bradshaw, God rest his soul, and Bernard Payton, who Bernard has been chief scout at lots of clubs. He followed Steve Bruce around, so whether or not he's moving again, I don't know, but super guys, absolutely, football people through and through, and they helped me an awful lot as a younger kid.
Very different system to now, for better or for worse. The United system of the late 80s and mid 90s had obviously phenomenal reputation. What do you think, having been a part of it, made it so special?
Attention to detail. Fergie was all over it. He was, I think he made it clear right from the get-go that he was going to take a leading role in running the youth party and helping people like Les Kershaw and the various scouts at the time to identify and offer the best product for the young players at the time. It was... The gaffer came to my house. I don't know how many managers, Premier League managers, would do that. Came to my house and all the neighbours are outside looking at the gaffer's big Mercedes outside. it's crazy. The lengths and the efforts, the determination that the gaffer and all of his staff put in to attract and sign the best young talent around. Hard work. I think that's some, the determination and the hard work, I think, was probably the differentiator between Manchester United and many of the other clubs. Don't get me wrong, the other clubs worked hard, but I don't think they had the support that the manager at Manchester United gave to the youth policy. I think that if they had it, things would have been a little different. The gaffer really supported it and made sure he knew that it was a vital part of his armoury, as well as the club's.
So they made, it sounds like, they made you feel a part of the club very early, and perhaps that gave you more of a zest to go and play for them rather than being dumped aside or parked aside as a separate entity.
Yeah, all football clubs do that. All football clubs are very nice to you when they want you. It's when things go badly that you find out, the true nature of people. But football's ruthless. So, I've been involved in it my whole life. There's very few friends in the game, true friends. It is a ruthless system, and it has to be. Anything that is as competitive as professional football is, it is always going to be like that. Yes, they did. They did absolutely make you feel welcome, but they weren't alone in doing that. I don't think that was a specific Manchester United thing by any stretch of the imagination.
The training at the time, how would you describe the style of the sessions?
As a youngster, 13, 14, 15, I wouldn't say that the coaches that worked with us at that time were any different than any other club. It wasn't until I was an apprentice that I started working with. Let's have a think. That there is, Eric had a lot to do with what I did. Neil Bailey as well. But I think differentiator. You think about Eric Harrison and. Was he the best coach in the world? No. Did he know the game? Yes. Did he know what was required to be a Manchester United player? Absolutely yes. But what Eric did, he certainly didn't reinvent the wheel from a football perspective, from a tactical perspective, from a technical perspective. But psychologically, he prepared you for life as a professional footballer better than anybody I've ever met. And people underestimate the psychological side of the game. It's absolutely huge, and he did an amazing job of preparing you for the competitiveness, the ruthlessness of professional sport. I've never seen anyone better.
I've been to a number of meetings and CPD events recently, and there does seem to be a slight shift away from the technical and physical side, and everyone's going, yeah, but you can have that, but if you haven't got that psych corner, you're not going to get anywhere. And I think it's taken a long time finally realising that.
Yeah, I think you look at recruitment, I think it's completely changed. When I was a kid, they were not solely, because English football has always been physical, so they're always looking for the physical aspects. They were looking for the best technical players, and certainly recently, in recent times, when I say in the last 10 years ago, they focused a lot on the technical side of the game. I think more recently, the last 5 years or so, clubs are recruiting athletes. because they know the systems, the development systems they have in place, and they're trying to develop athletes. They're trying to identify athletes at a very young age, which is tough to do. But they know that if that young player is in their system for 10 years, they can actually turn that athlete into a footballer. And yeah, the side now that you rightly bring up is, it doesn't matter if they're technically gifted and they're an athlete, they have to have the mentality, they have to be a winner. And that's what Sir Alex certainly, you know, I've gone from Fergie, the gaffer, Sir Alex, I don't know what to call him, and Eric did to a massive extent. They did that so well because they knew the rigours of the sport. And you know what? I don't know the methods that they employed. I don't know whether you could employ those same methods today without getting sacked, without getting health and safety all over you. The things that we did, you know, that were character building. That's exactly what they were. They were to build mental strength, and if you couldn't hack it, you know, you were out the door.
I was going to come to a question there, and I was just going to simply say, was it harsh?
The environment that they created at Manchester United, I haven't been to Carrington for a long time. I'm sure it exists today. That as a young player, or as a player, when you walk through the door of the training ground, you were immediately on your toes. You had to be impeccable. You'd sit downstairs. If the gaffer or Eric had seen you with your feet on the chairs, for example, you'd have been nailed. If you were reading the newspaper, sat in the canteen reading the newspaper, you know, relaxing, you'd have been nailed. Because you know everything was about being a pro, getting there. If you've got to do your jobs, if you haven't done your jobs, you know you're gonna get, you know, sorted out. If you've done your jobs, then you've got to help other people do their jobs. So even that in itself, that kind of upbringing that we were fortunate to have, you know, it's got nothing to do with football. My job was to clean the gym, but I knew that if I didn't wipe all the sweat off the exercise bike, and the foreman came and seen it, and I was reported to Eric, or, you know, that God forbid the gaffer got involved, you know, life wouldn't be worth living. So you very quickly learn that you had to be, you know, impeccable all the time, in every sense, on and off the field. And that's a tough job to do. That's a tough job to maintain those standards in a organisation as big as Manchester United. That's, you've got a lot of good people working with you to be able to do that, who are you know, singing from the same hymn sheet or following orders to the letter.
Once you were in at 14 and 15, did you get much opportunity to play outside of the United environment, or was it very much channeled into the United setup?
Well, I went to the FA National School of Excellence, so at Littleshall, at 14. So I left home at 14 to go there for 2 years. And in the first year, I'd already been involved with United before I went there. And United's advice was, don't go. Phil Neville had been invited, you know, he's a couple of years older than me, and they advised him not to go. And I think that's because United have a certain way of doing things. And they do things differently. They were never that supportive of the England setup. Had I been Scottish, I think things might have been differently. But once I'd signed, the only exposure I had of not Manchester United's methodology was playing for England. And they're very similar. They're very same. When you're representing your country, you have to uphold all the qualities that Manchester United, you know, demand and some. So the two were very similar.
Both setups, high standards, strict rules, much freedom. And I mean that both as a person, and also in terms of playing style.
United, you were certainly given enough rope to hang yourself, and many did. You had freedom. It was a decision that you made. You didn't have any freedom once you were inside the training ground. Outside the training ground, absolutely. You were your own person. The gaffer had a network, and the club had a network of people who would keep their eye on you. But you could do whatever you wanted outside of the training and the game, situations. Absolutely.
At what stage in this whole process did you actually think, I'm going to make it, I'm going to be a pro?
Well, I signed pro on my 17th birthday, and I was born in September, so I'd only actually been through the door, a couple of months, and I was a pro. And I think, looking back, there's differences in... you can sign a professional contract, it doesn't make you a pro. You can play 10 games, it doesn't make you a pro, so to speak. I suppose it does, but it doesn't mean you're going to make a living out of the game. I was lucky. I didn't retire until I was 33, and I had made a good living out of the game. When did I realise I was a pro? It probably wasn't at United. It was probably at Blackburn or somewhere like that, or Barnsley, in my early 20s. That you think, I can do this now, and I'm pretty, maybe not at the Champions League, Premier League level, but I can. I'm a professional footballer, and I can stay in this for a long time. And it probably wasn't until I left United really that you start thinking like that.
And then when you got into the first team at United, did training change? Was there a drastic difference between training for the reserves and training with Sir Alex and with his lieutenants?
Well, Eric Harrison was his lieutenant, so there wasn't. It wasn't until I left Manchester United, having been brought up through the system at the highest level with England and United, it wasn't until you left there and went to Barnsley, who were on loan, who were at the time top of the Championship, that you realised the difference. And it wasn't necessarily the actual playing. Listen, don't get me wrong, training with the first team was unbelievable. It was intense, it was fast, it was super competitive. And that's what the difference was going elsewhere. It was that intensity. At United, you were pedal to the metal the whole time. There was no room for any kind of slack in any sense. At Barnsley, or every club I have been at subsequently, there was never that intensity, never. So I enjoyed that as a player. I actually, going to Barnsley was like a breath of fresh air. It was like, whoa, relax now, and that felt nice. Was it good professionally? Absolutely not. It wasn't good professionally. And if I'd have been able to maintain that level of intensity that I'd experienced at Manchester United, maybe I'd have stayed in the Premier League longer. Maybe I would have had a better career. But the fact that it was so much different, and you noticed that difference when you went to other clubs, credit to the way things were done at Manchester United.
That's interesting. I'm just thinking, is it possible just the other way, and for some people, but what happened and the style at United, they might have found it suffocating.
I think if you ask guys who haven't come through the system at United and weren't involved at United from a very young age, I didn't know any different. See, that's, you don't know any different. It's only when you left that you realised there was something different. But if you'd come the other way, so you interview Jonathan Greening, for example. You interview Jonathan Greening about what he felt. I know he came young, but when he arrived as a 19-year-old from York or wherever he was, Jono will tell you that it was a massive difference. Imagine coming from York, who were like League Two or whatever they were, and then coming into Manchester United, he wouldn't have known what the hell hit him. And even you know, more senior players. I think if you interviewed Teddy Sheringham and he spent his whole life at Forest, Millwall, Tottenham, and he comes to Manchester United, he would notice a difference, big time, into the way Manchester United operated and the level of intensity, the training sessions and the games and the environment at United in comparison to these other clubs. Even top clubs, you know, or decent Millwall, maybe not, but Forest and Tottenham at the time, you know, top clubs.
Chris, you've got a few questions now.
So, do you want to quickly take us through your path into coaching before we go on to how you started in America?
Well, as a player, like many players do, I had no. If you'd have asked me as a 25-year-old, John, do you want to go into coaching? No. You know, I'd have said, no, I want to buy houses and be a property developer and do a bit of stockbroking and this and that. Day trading I used to do when I was younger. But it's only actually when you get to 28, 29, 30, and you actually think, well, hold on a minute, I've spent my entire life, and your entire life, focused on one thing and one thing only, and, oh, by the way, now you get to the stage where you can never do that again. You can never do that again. And the toughest thing about being a professional footballer is retirement and not being a professional footballer. So many lads go off the rails because they have been focused on one thing and all of a sudden they can't do that thing anymore. I can't think of another parallel to that. The only thing I could think of is if, you know, God forbid, somebody got injured somehow and couldn't do their job. That's the only way I can see it, because that's basically what it is. It's a physical disability, aging, that doesn't enable you to do your job. So when you got to that stage, it was like, oh, damn, I better start thinking about something in football. This is all I know. So I started doing my coaching badges with the PFA and found I really enjoyed it, coaching the U12s at Notts County. And then graduated up to the U16s, enjoyed that, and I continued to coach towards the end of my career, and then went to Australia to play and continued to coach there, finished in Australia, and then fell on a job coaching full-time in Italy. And, you know, I think I discovered that I was pretty good at it. You know, I've got all this knowledge and experience that I can pass on. I don't know, you can tell me different, the people listening can tell you different. I was a good communicator and I was able to get that message across to people in a way that the kids understood. And I got satisfaction out of watching them take whatever they wanted from that new understanding that they had, that, and the improvement that they made as a player, directly from my knowledge. Any teacher will tell you that's hugely satisfying, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. So you're currently working in the New York Club Soccer League. So could you quickly give us an overview of what it is and what your role is within the organisation?
Sure. The New York, the landscape of youth soccer in America is very, very complicated, unnecessarily complicated. But there is a branch of the youth game called US Club Soccer. It's an organization that runs kind of like a large segment of US soccer, youth soccer. And one of their big leagues in the North, the New York Soccer League. I also work as their technical director. I also work directly with another big US club league in the Northeast called the New England Premiership.
Yeah.
And in both of those leagues, I run development programs, player development programs, which are coaching programs for the very strongest players. They come underneath US Club Soccer's banner, but the leagues need someone to run them. And I run them on behalf of the leagues and US Club Soccer. So I'm lucky in that I get to... It's like having the old pick of the league team. So when I played in the Tamworth League in the Midlands there, and we'd have a pick of the league team. And the pick of the league team would then go and play against other pick of the league teams from other leagues in the area. That's a bit like what we do here. The difference being my pick of the league team is 1,200 teams and three states and, you know, 25 million people. So it's a massive, it's not the Tamworth League, you know, with eight teams. Or it's a big, big, because the US is so vast. So it means, luckily, that I get to work with some good players. And the standard of the kids over here is getting better. I know it is everywhere, but the kids are getting better over here faster. I think they're catching up to an extent. It's going to take, it'll take decades, and it'll take a cultural shift in the US before they're anywhere near like they are back in Europe. But there's significant improvement.
Yeah, I remember from our previous conversation, you said the mentality of winning in America is obscene compared to over in Europe. And it's something they need to change to help with the development of younger players.
There's a propensity to think winning is a good thing.
Yeah.
Winning in youth football can mean, more often than not, means you're taking shortcuts. And you can't take shortcuts to develop players. So I think there's a lack of understanding, a huge lack of understanding, in that, you know, kicking the ball over the top for the big kid to run on and score, many short-sighted people see that as a big, as the greatest thing. In reality, anybody who knows the game, anybody who knows anything about developing players knows that you have to take time and you have to have a thorough development program. Touching all the areas of development to be able to make develop professional players. And don't forget, you're not developing professional players here in the US. You're developing 16-year-olds who are going to get a college scholarship. So there's very few people who have actually developed players right the way to the pro level. It's beginning, thankfully, it's beginning now. And there's rules in place where kids can dip their toe into the college game and come out of it immediately before they become damaged goods and go and play in the MLS and go and play in the USL for second string teams of MLS clubs. And it's doing them so much more good than spending 4 years in college. You know, these guys, you think about the Clint Dempseys of the world who spent 4 years in college and still were a pro. Mm. That is an amazing achievement to be able to do that, by the way. You know, if I'd have spent 4 years in college, there's no way I'd have been a pro at any level. That's how detrimental the college game is to developing players.
Did you want to say something, Peter?
Well, I was just thinking, speaking of rules in place, I've not asked anyone from the States this, or who works in the States this, but I've seen and heard about the no-heading rule. Can you elaborate on that and what you think about it?
I'm free to talk. That comes about from a parent, I believe, and listen, I might paraphrase and I might have got the facts slightly wrong here, but there was a player out west who suffered badly from concussions. His parent must have been a very powerful, wealthy guy or lady who thought he or she would do something about this and started a court case against the USSF and its affiliates, of which US Club, US Youth Soccer, all these say soccer, AYS, so all these different organisations that fit underneath US soccer on the youth side. And rather than have this court case and have all the issues with this court case, the Federation, and that could have been a nightmare for them, an absolute nightmare for them. Instead of going through with all that, the Federation said, yeah, absolutely, we'll bring in these protocols and we will limit heading for the younger kids. And that's what they did. And they were forced to do that to a certain extent. So it's not, you know, anyone back in Europe who's thinking, or anywhere else is thinking, oh, that's typical of the US, what are they thinking, trying to change the rules of our game, which is what I would have thought of 10 years ago. It's not that. They, these guys were forced to do that with the threat of litigation hanging over them. That coaches can't practice heading below the age of 11, and from U11 down in games, heading is banned. So, and there are all kinds of concussion protocols in place that clubs or organisations must have dealing with the effects of concussions. And this again, it stems from this player, but I think it stems also a lot from American football and the issues they had had with concussions. But it's a different. I don't think I've ever seen anybody who has got a concussion from heading the football. Sure, clash of heads, kicked in the head. Yes, absolutely. But I don't think it's got anything to do with actually heading the ball.
Not the balls these days. You think the balls in the, exactly, in the 60s. Or the,
yeah. I think a better argument that they could have made is, you know, speaking to the ball manufacturers and making the size 4 ball, you know, an ounce lighter or whatever, rather than trying to ban heading. And it has caused an absolute nightmare. There's lots of new initiatives that the Federation have brought out recently. And of course, you know, what do the coaches over here do? What do the parent coaches, all the terrible coaches over in the US do? They encourage their kids to kick the ball long, knowing full well that the kids can't head it. They're taking long corners into the box because they can score. So rather than use this as an advantage to play below head height and play attractive football that's going to aid development, playing through the thirds, playing short corners, etc., etc., they are now doing the complete opposite and, you know, sticking to type and trying to take advantage of the fact that little Johnny, U9, can't head it, and kicking it as high in the air as you possibly can. Deal with that one. So it's crazy. It's crazy, but it's the market that we're in.
That's okay. So, So we discussed in the last time the difference between European academy system and the American is that Americans have to pay to learn how to play.
For the most part, yeah. It's a pay-to-play system in the US for the vast majority of the players.
Yeah, so the coaching methods are completely different because they can complain. That was the...
Yes, yeah.
If you're paying for something, you have the right to complain.
Yeah, so, there's a lot of good things that the Federation are trying to do. The highest level of youth soccer in the US is called the Development Academy. Yeah. And one of the aims of the Development Academy is to reduce the cost for the players. So, I may be wrong here, but of the MLS development, the MLS clubs who have development academies, which I think is virtually all... virtually all are free to the user. So in New York, you've got New York City FC, you've got the Red Bulls.
Yeah.
Okay. Two MLS franchises, both of which are free. So any kid from, you know, who's involved at the highest level with the Red Bulls or New York City FC doesn't pay. Whatever programs they offer are free. And you take New York City FC, they're extensive now. So they're training 3-4 times a week, traveling to tournaments, travelling back to the UK, to City, all over the place. It is, the MLS clubs are doing things exactly the same as the professional clubs back home. There might be slight differences that they do have, one or two of the MLS clubs now have residential programmes, and so they get, you know, even more contact time than our coaches would back in the UK, back in England. But for the most part, they're doing the right thing. It's the level below that where you could argue a lot of professional football, particularly over in the US, because the holes in the net in the US are huge. So there are lots of players that have the potential to be professional players who slip the net at the development academy level and then don't get a chance. And that's really what I do. I try and catch those kids who have missed that development academy, those late developers, or those kids not identified to be involved with the development academy. And I try to help those kids and provide a secondary pathway for them into the top level.
Is it still a huge problem that you lose good players around 13, 14 to the other major American sports, or do players tend to stick with soccer these days? Or?
No, I don't think so. I think, if anything, it might be the other way. I haven't heard of many of the kids that I coach leaving the game. I think it's probably more prevalent the other way around, which is great. You know, people are starting to realise how good football is, to be honest, and how good a game it is to play. You think in America, you've got baseball. You know, listen, I'm a big cricket fan, so I won't say it's boring, but you say it's limited on excitement for the narrow-minded, I'll say. You've got American football, where realistically you've got to have so much equipment to play properly, so many of you, half the time you stood on the sideline. It might be a good game to watch on telly, but I can't see it being a good game to play. Never played it. You can throw it around to each other, but that's about it. Ice hockey, which is ridiculously expensive to play. Basketball is the only one, really, that is the equivalent, that has the ease. You know, everywhere in New York City there's basketball courts. If we could put little football, little five-side football pitches all over the place, it would be great. And there's a drive to do that, which would be amazing, because it's, you know, it's two jumpers, a goalpost. You just need a ball and two guys, and you're there. So basketball has that similarity because there's so many, you know, basketball hoops around the place.
So I just bought futsal straight away there, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, multi-use games areas are prevalent now in this country. You won't get somewhere that's just got goals. There'll be a goal with a hoop above it. And if you just put that there, chuck a futsal in, you've got a whole heap of players ready to go. And it's not going to take a huge chunk out of someone's budget to change those areas.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, you play futsal on the basketball courts, no problem at all. And listen, they do. You know, their futsal in New York, for example, is very popular with the less wealthy kids, so to speak. And that's being politically correct, but the poorer kids are playing. They're out there, especially the Hispanic lads and girls. They love to play. They're playing all over the place. So it's just that in the US, football has a reputation of being a bit like rugby or cricket back home. It's the rich man's sport. It's more well-to-do sport. And I think that's more so on the girls' side. And there's been a lot of stuff in the news about the national team not representing the US and you know, the vast majority of the youth national teams are blonde-haired girls with ponytails from well-to-do backgrounds rather than, you know, the Hispanic girls from Southern California or wherever, who we all know are fantastic. So it's tough for those kids because the game is expensive. It is, you know, a typical club in New York, you know, a good level club at the level I'm working at is probably charging $2,000 minimum, and there's clubs that are charging more than that, you know, closer to $3,000. And that doesn't include all the expenses that you've got. If you're playing for an ECNL club in New York, you're probably paying your fees of $3,000. Then you're travelling every other weekend, hotel fees, tournaments, flights. It sounds stupid, but you're probably not far short of $10,000 a year to have your daughter play, which is, as a person who never spent a penny, maybe my mum had to go to Tesco and buy a load of oranges twice a year because it was our turn to supply the half-time oranges. That was it. That was the limit of the costs.
Yeah. Buy some boots and do that.
You know, it's crazy, really.
So these talented Hispanic, or well, could be from somewhere of a different background, players have, in some ways, actually got more chance of making it at the pro level than they have at the grassroots level because it costs less.
Yes, but the problem is to get, and this is where New York City FC are doing a good thing. They're trying to link with the community. They're trying to form relationships with clubs to identify those players early. They want access to those players because they realise that. They realise the gene pool in the, and the mentality, comes back to that again, the mentality of the players who are from less privileged backgrounds lends itself more to making it as a player. Making it as a professional player, that grit, that determination, that resilience that you need to be a professional athlete is more prevalent with the underprivileged, in the underprivileged communities. And they're doing a job to try and identify those players early and offering programs for free. So they know that, listen, they know exactly what's going on, the people in the US, the people at the highest levels, the Federation, the people who run the Development Academy, they know all of this. It's just trying to get around it. And they are doing it slowly. But it's to change any culture is going to take an awful lot of time. And listen, in America, you pay for everything. Absolutely everything. It is, you don't get anything for free. And that's a very different culture to one we've got in the UK. So to shift that culture is going to take time.
Yeah, I've spoken to people about this, the contrast, because here, if someone says at grassroots, by the way, it's going to cost you £300 a season, they go, nah, see you later. But compared to, as you just said, what happens in America, if it was £300 for the season, fantastic, bargain. And it's a stark contrast, and it's just from the expectations that people have and what they're used to. Here in England, it's, we don't pay for our grassroots football, what are you talking about? But in America, because as you said, pay for everything, like, yeah, sure, have it.
Well, think of it like this and think a little bit deeper. Everybody involved in football, virtually everybody involved in football in the US, is paid. So that's a big statement. But the people who are in powerful positions within US youth football are paid to be in those positions. So the decision makers are happy for the status quo because they're getting paid because of it. And that's that's going to take the biggest shift. People need to make some really big and hard decisions and unselfish decisions for the betterment of the game in this country, and that is a very big ask. That is a very, very big ask for people to do. So you take US club soccer, you take US youth soccer, AYS, whatever it may be. People are getting paid, and you know they're relying on the game for their income. Listen, I'm one of them. I'm technical director of a league. I do this full time. I am paid somewhat by the programs that I run and somewhat by the clubs within our league who pay for involvement within our league. If we as a league said we're going to run this program for free, then there's five or six people who are involved with the league who don't get paid anymore. You know, well, that's fine. If I can go to Walmart and say, right, here's my shopping, and you give it me for free because I'm doing this for free. It's, you know, it's very tough, and that's the bigger issue, I think, that we've got to try and get to. You look at home. Everybody wants to work in an academy, right? So brilliant. You can go and work in an academy, but you're only going to make £30,000 a year working in an academy. £25,000-£30,000 a year. Some of these full time roles in a Category 1 academy back home at a Premier League club are paying absolute buttons because they know there are lots of qualified people out there who would give their right arm to work with, I don't know, Chelsea youngsters, Arsenal youngsters, whoever. So the clubs can pay buttons. So it's the same on the opposite way round, kind of, back in the UK. Interesting.
Same problems, reasons.
Yeah.
It is. And it's very interesting to think of a system where grassroots operates on elite money and elite operates on grassroots money.
Yeah.
Very, it's as we're talking about.
Ash Calver has sent in a listener's question. So, how do you feel the quality of US youngsters compared to the youngsters you came through the youth ranks with?
At So from U8, U9, U10,
yeah,
maybe even U11, they compare very well. As soon as you start going older than that, there's a huge drop off.
Mm.
If I took a 2006 kid born in 2006 to City, Everton, Wolves, a few months back, and he compared very well. You know, they wanted, a couple of clubs wanted to sign him. But if I waited and took him again when he's 15, the chances of them, he would have fallen so far behind. If he stays in the same place, he would have fallen so far behind our kids that he would stand no chance. Now, and part of that is the coaching. Part of that is there aren't enough people in the US who understand the game. And when I mean the game, I mean the 11v11 game.
Yeah.
And it's not until they get to U13 over here, so 2004s this season, that they're actually playing 11v11. So up to that point, it's mostly, it's kind of less about the coach and more about the kids, you know, having fun and individual stuff. You think of the development of a younger player, as a four-year-old, you can't think about anything else other than yourself. And that kind of mentality changes as you grow. And as soon as you have to start thinking about other people, and there isn't the coaching to be able to give them the right advice. And I think that's a big issue. So that there's a huge drop-off at those age groups.
All right, so before we finish, do you want to plug your social media? So your Twitter?
Me?
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. J. Curtis Soccer is my handle on Twitter. I'm pretty active on there if anyone wants to follow. I try and retweet interesting stuff with people that I follow and give as much information as I possibly can about what's going on in the US. But it's I enjoy Twitter. It's good. I love getting into dialogue with people. I like the way that you can do that. You know, complete strangers, you can have conversations and arguments and yeah. Whatever differences of opinion. Is that it makes for a lot of fun. The wife complains a lot when I'm doing it in the middle of the night, but I enjoy it absolutely.
Yeah, and I still have all the links from the last interview, so I'll put them all in the description below this interview. I'm sure we could have gone for another hour, but it's only meant to be a half hour show. Right. So I've really enjoyed speaking to you today. I'm sure Peter has as well. And again, I'd love to have you on again in the future.
So. Yeah, no problem, guys. Listen, this is a pretty good time of year for me. It's this time of the day as well works pretty well. I'm not coaching tonight, so night off.
Thanks, John. I enjoyed that, and maybe next time dig a bit more into the coaching side.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy if you want some content. Happy to help, guys. When will you have it? When will you have it done by?
If it's not, I could have it out tonight. I'm planning to have it out tonight. If it's not too much editing, so.
You're not getting this one under half an hour, mate.
No.
Sorry, guys. Talk too much.
That's all right.
It's usually me.
I just won't put the bit our bit in at the beginning. Oh, we can use that for the next show.
All right, guys. Well, listen, I've got to crack on with some work. I'll leave it to it. You know where I am. If you want to chat about anything, I'm happy to help.
Brilliant. Thank you.
All right.
I'll speak again soon.
See you later.
Okay, bye.